And our next case is in re Supervised Estate of Brian Scott Short, A18-1682. And I see both attorneys are here. Mr. Westrick, thank you for making the effort. I hope you're okay.
I'm fine, Your Honor. Just call me Crash. No, it's the poor guy in the Honda Fit that hit my Jeep SUV that... That was the problem. I was kind of the bounce.
Yeah. So. Sometimes people get hurt in bounces. And I want to thank Mr. Rattle for being flexible and able to reschedule. So you each will have 15 minutes with 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. Please state your name for the record when you approach the podium, and the podium goes up and down if you want to adjust it.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is John Westrick. I represent the appellant and the cross-respondent in this matter. The issues are, in a sense, straightforward, but because there's not a lot of guidance in the statute for them, because they haven't really come up, or at least before the appeals, the issue that we were concerned with is whether or not the court made an error in allowing distribution of income, albeit not principal, when we don't know, as a way of protecting my client's unliquidated interest in its claim against the estate without the court below knowing how much money is in the estate.
So you would agree that the crux of your argument is that the district court should have made a determination as to the value of the estate to properly determine a reasonable amount to withhold.
I do, Your Honor. And the reason for that is well, as counsel points out in his response brief, well, that isn't a factor that's in the Pennsylvania case. The Pennsylvania case talks about balancing. And it's kind of hard to balance if you don't know what's on the other side. And again, this is not purely statutory, but just say in the family law context, if the court has to decide how much maintenance to award, it's kind of hard for the court to say, I'm going to award maintenance when I don't know what one of the parties makes.
But it's hard here in this case. I think you filed an appeal with the Eighth Circuit by this point.
Well, I haven't. Fortunately, Your Honor, I'm not involved in that litigation. Mr. Rattle does not have the benefits of a non-participation there. So there is an appeal in the Eighth Circuit,
and
yes.
Judge Thunheim was pretty frank in his assessment of your client's case.
I would agree with that. Again, I don't know much about that area of the law, but I understand necessarily as part of the balancing test, the court's going to say, you already lost and you lost pretty good. I mean, I can't put a different thing on it. They lost pretty good. So I understand that that would go in, but to me, that's just one of the factors that you necessarily need to have some idea of what's in the estate. Well, let's just give an example. If the estate had, I'm not saying it has this, $1 billion, a $2 million set aside might not seem like a big deal. If the estate has $500,000, a $400,000 set aside might be a really big deal. So as a result of that, I think that that's something that needs to be addressed.
Well, and the district court was faced with the PR saying 50 grand at the most, and your client saying,
Actually, my client's attorney in the federal cases, he's from New Jersey, and frankly, I think that explains a lot, but well, I see Mr. Rattle grinning. I thought, frankly, that was a little high, personally, for someone who just lost pretty soundly in front of a federal judge. But you'll notice my name's not on that affidavit. So I think that the problem here isn't that the court doesn't have the ability to exercise its discretion. I think it does. I just think that in order to allow effective appellate review and to properly balance the issue, that this is something that needs to be done.
Did you ask the district court to compel the PR to disclose the assets?
I don't believe at that point I had filed a formal motion, but yes, we had had discussions about us knowing how much is in the estate, and I understand why Mr. Rattle has not want to do that, But yes, we did want to know this information, and I pointed that out, I believe, to the referee below that he needed to know this information to resolve this motion.
Okay, well, I guess, I mean, there's a difference in my mind between, on the one hand, making an effort, I mean, on this somewhat collateral but obviously relevant issue of you know, say a motion to compel or a motion to require the PR to disclose the values on the inventory rather than saying to be determined. And on the other hand, accepting that as a given and then arguing to the district court that in light of the absence of information, you should do such and such. You should err on the safe side.
Well,
but I guess I'm just wondering if that's part of your appeal, that the district court did not require the PR to do that, or if that, for purposes of our analysis, is just a given that the value of the estate is unknown.
Well, Mr. Reddle and I disagree on this because we've had other litigation about it below. I believe that they're required by statute to file the...
Okay, but did you seek to sort of enforce that? Did you try to bump that issue up to the court and say they are required, please make them do it?
I did argue, I believe, to the court that they should be required to do it. Having said that, I don't believe a party should be allowed to violate a statutory duty and then say, I want an advantage of it. To me, they came to the court for relief. They said, we want you to allow us to make distributions. And we said no, and then they withheld part of the information that's solely in their control right now from doing so. And again, going back to the family law context, if I come in and want to change in my maintenance, I don't get to say, I know what my income is, but I'm not going to tell you, because so, there's a statutory duty to do it. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
So what statute do you say the PR violated?
I don't know if I have it with me. It's the inventory statute, and then there's another statute that says, thank you, Mr. Reddle. We get along very nicely, he and I. 3-706, duty of personal representative, 524, and then there's the supplemental, which would be 707, which says if you file one, you have to supplement it when you have more information.
So do you think this... You both are citing Pennsylvania
yes.
law and Colorado law and Nebraska. And do you think this is a case that we should publish on?
I do, and I think we should publish it for two reasons. One of which is to lay out a guideline for the probate courts for this particular issue, which is what the court needs to know and what the court needs to do.
So would we follow the Mellon factors?
I think the Mellon factors are pretty good. I do.
And I think you both would agree with that.
Yes.
You would apply them differently, but you would agree they're a good roadmap.
And I think the other issue that, you know, is the cross-appeal issue is the to specifically hold that the probate division has the discretion to decide whether or not it should make a case go from unsupervised to supervised and actually make that a four-square holding, and then once you say discretion, you control the standard of review. You really give the tools to the probate division to know how to do this. I mean, yes, Your Honor.
Well, can I just go to the application of the Mellon factors?
Certainly.
I mean, as I look at this, we have two competing interests. Your client wants everything to be held in reserve in case they win the lottery and win their case. On the other hand, the respondent here is, and the cross appellant, I guess, too, is basically saying, look, we want our money. We've been waiting forever. Let's get this thing done. You've already lost in federal court. Let's do it. And it looks like to me the judge just basically split the baby and said, look, I'm going to release the income to the beneficiaries of this estate, but I am, but we, as to the principal, we're going to maintain that, and basically, if I had to paraphrase, the judge looked at the status of this claim in federal court and said, I think the principal's going to cover it, and I don't even care. I don't even have to know what it is because it looks like it's going to be zero. And its current status, that's the nature of the claim. How is that an abuse of discretion?
Well,
if you could explain that.
Certainly. Well, first of all, if the court had said, I think that the case is worth zero, and so that's why I'm not doing it, that would be different. But that's not what the court said. What the court said is, I can't make this determination because I don't know what the estate is worth, and so I'm just going to punt on that. And just as an example, let's say that what the estate holds are bitcoins. Let's just use bitcoins.
Well, except I want to stop you there because the court makes a finding, it's finding 9, that Judge Thunheim dismissed the whole thing in its entirety. And basically even goes further and says this supports that this order would seem to support the personal representative's position that it should be totally disallowed. And the court, again, exercising discretion, says, no, let's just wait here because they can still appeal, and I'm not going to do anything here until this appeal is done. It basically is, if I had to paraphrase the order. And I guess my question to you is, in light of that, why is this an abuse of discretion?
Well, first of all, saying this is the position that it supports the position of the other side isn't necessarily a finding that he finds the case is worthless. He also below said...
but isn't that a consideration of the nature of the claim? And they've already been kicked out. I mean, it's a very strong order.
I think that
from Judge Thunheim.
It is. I think that it is a factor that's to be done. But I was going back to, let's say there was something in the estate that doesn't have a lot of value but's generating a lot of income. So to say this undisclosed and unknown amount of principal is enough to balance the scales while we distribute another unknown and undisclosed amount of income just seems to me to be wrongheaded. And the court said,
quite makes sense. If something is generating a lot of income, then it intrinsically has a lot of value.
Well, sometimes it does. Sometimes you take a debenture. When Apple computers first came out, people had debentures that had a face value of a small amount of money, but because of the way they were treated as almost preferred stock, and they were generating huge amounts of income, but the actual face value of the document was of the debenture itself was very small. So I don't know whether that's the case, because I don't know.
But going back to Judge Hooten's question, it gets to the standard of review. You're saying it would be discretionary?
There's no question this is a discretionary. To me, this is not an issue of, this isn't one of those things. This is a discretion. I think I say so in my, but my view is when you have a court that exercises its discretion, it has to have the tools to exercise its discretion, and if it doesn't have those, and if you just look at finding 12,
of which order are we
of the court's order dated October 15th, finding 12, the court is unable to determine whether the suggested relief in the statute, such as bond, mortgage, or security, would be an important safeguard. When applying the balance test, this is in 15, the court finds a total suspension is unreasonable. The court talks about adverse tax consequences, but doesn't really make a finding. And so it just says, I'm going to allow this, and then the conclusion, the court's unable to determine an appropriate sum of money to be reserved as sufficient protection for the claim. And so when the court says, I'm unable to do this, I don't think the court's exercised its discretion. It's punted because it has to. And that's really so it's the process here, not the result that I'm taking issue with.
Who has the burden here?
Pardon?
Who has the burden?
I believe they had the burden on some things and we had the burden on others. When they had the burden,
but you're the one that's asking that amount be reserved.
Yeah. So on that, I think,
isn't that your burden?
Well,
I mean, your client's burden.
It is, unless we don't have the information because they have it. I mean, again, this is, you would say, who's got the most? If I'm a spouse receiving maintenance and I want more, I have the burden, but the other spouse doesn't get to say, I know something you don't know, and I'm not going to tell you how much money I have, so that you can bring your motion.
Well,
So, I mean, my view is if we prevail on this, this is going to be a remand. You're not going to say this is right or this is wrong. This is going to be a remand.
I'd like to understand your argument. If you could please turn to page 5 of your brief. You quote in full the statute 3-810. Am I correct in understanding that the district court's action, I think, tell me if I'm right or wrong, was solely pursuant to the last word of this word otherwise?
That's how that was one of the things that the district court looked at, yes.
I think you're in B2. You're trying to have, A does not apply, I don't think. B is what does apply, is may provide for it, and B1 doesn't apply because there's no consent. We're in B2. The other options that were not, I think, either asked for or ordered, trust, mortgage, bond. So really, it was just all this otherwise.
I agree with that, Your Honor, that the court's got to fashion some kind of the rest of the statute, I think, talks about equity. There may be another.
Am I correct? I mean, both parties, I think it was the PR who sought this relief, right? Permission to distribute income.
That is correct.
And then you, it was it in your own motion or in a counter argument to that motion, asked for this, what I'll call a set aside or a reservation?
I think that we asked in the counter that there be a set aside, but I may have done it in a motion because I was following direction from New Jersey Council.
So you were invoking then this statute?
I may have been, yes.
Thank you.
Oh, and I'm sorry, I'm out of time.
Can I ask one more question? Is it your position that the court did apply the Mellon factors?
I'm not sure whether it did or not, because it didn't. It did not delineate them as they are delineated in that case.
I know they talk about, they don't mention Mellon in the order.
Correct.
It's not mentioned by the district court. But there's also, but what is mentioned is this balancing test. So, right. And did both parties argue Mellon before the district court?
I know that Mr. Reddle did, but I think I did as well. I thought that was a pretty good test.
Okay. All right. And is there anything that you can point us to that indicates that the judge didn't apply that test?
No.
Okay.
And we were fortunate in that, you know, the referee that did this was a very experienced probate practitioner. We just wasn't someone who grabbed off the street, so to speak. So
the application of Mellon has never been an issue in the case?
Correct. We're not making that an issue,
okay,
if the judge applied it.
All right.
And
you're not claiming the judge failed to apply?
No, I'm not.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, and if it pleases the court, I'm John Reddall, R-E-D-D-A-L-L, on behalf of the respondent and cross-appellant. And I'd like to, at the outset, just address this sort of spousal maintenance example that we've been talking about, because I think it really gets to the heart of this issue. If I'm the person going in and asking for spousal maintenance, I have to establish my need. It's a threshold factor. And frankly, as the payor party, I could withhold my income, but I would suffer consequences from doing that. The court would set the maintenance based on just the need without mitigating it by my ability to pay. And that's really important here, because the threshold factor is, what is the value of the claim? And then there may be a discount applied to that, there may be something like that. The value of the estate, which is the central thrust of the initial appeal, is only relevant if the estate were to use it to mitigate and say, look, you think you should hold back $7.25 million, but we only have $500,000. Doesn't really make any sense to make us go get a bond for $700,000. Why don't you set aside this much? It's not an initial factor in establishing the value of the holdback. It's a mitigating factor to reduce it. And so I think I wanted to kind of go through this because we have sort of three issues, two of which are sort of related and one sort of separate. The first one being the conversion to supervised status.
Well, and I want to ask you about that because, I mean, it's clear there's a claim out there and that and you will agree that there is a right of the appellant to make sure that the estate doesn't get dissipated before they've resolved that claim. Isn't that a fair statement?
Not entirely.
I mean, because if this isn't supervised, how in the world is the appellant going to be assured that that estate isn't dissipated?
So specifically under the probate code,
yeah.
I believe it's section 1004, the non-disallowed claims or non-barred claims can be prosecuted against distributees. So if we were to distribute the assets to the devisees of this estate and this claim were to come through, it's theoretically possible, if we did not get relief from the court, that the creditor could go try to collect those assets from the distributees as long as they still had them.
Why would you want to? I mean, that's
I'm not saying I want to do that.
I mean, why? Number one, why would you want to do that to your...
We wouldn't. And that's specifically why we brought the motion that we brought, because the purpose of the motion and the logic behind the Mellon and the Powers cases is to say that the court has the ability to cut that off. The court has the ability to say, because we are an equitable division of the court and because our job is to devolve assets, we have the ability to say, look, you've had your chance to prove your claim.
But then why don't we review that for an abuse of discretion? Because you were clear in your headings that you think it's error.
I do think that it's an error, and the reason I think it's an error is because the court, just to back up procedurally what had happened, we brought a motion. The only response to that motion, the sole response, was an affidavit from out-of-state counsel that they would be appealing. There were no counter motions. There were no responsive motions. There were no memoranda of law. There was no response substantively at all. At the hearing, the simple argument was resting on the pleadings, which they're actually motion papers, but there was nothing else asserted at the hearing. No witnesses, nothing. So the record at the time that the court made the initial June order, wherein it determined that it could not terminate the claim, the record did not involve any proof of the value of the claim, whether it should be there.
And that's where the judge held open the question of whether or not it would go from unsupervised to supervised.
No, he converted it at that
in the
order.
June hearing?
Yes. And then he continued it in the second order.
Okay.
And his sole basis was because there's a claim. And I don't dispute that there's an asserted claim. Dispute the validity of the claim, but I don't dispute that it's been asserted. But that's your ticket into the door. That's not why you get the relief. That's why you get to ask for the relief.
I mean, but isn't the whole purpose of a supervised probate would be to provide some protection for these claimants?
That's potentially one reason. The reason for a supervised probate is to provide the court with continuing jurisdiction over it, and therefore it's not... They're not special proceedings where jurisdiction is only invoked at each time. The court has continuing jurisdiction over the estate and the personal representative, and sua sponte issue orders if the PR is not doing what the court wants to do. That's the reason for supervised administration. It's not simply an asset holding mechanism, which is what it's being used for here.
But why is that? I mean, are you claiming that's an inappropriate reason?
There's no basis for the court to have found that there was going to be harm to someone interested in the estate, which is what's required under the statute. So specifically, the statute requires an affirmative showing that conversion is necessary for the protection of persons interested in the estate. So you have to be interested in the estate to ask, and then it needs to be necessary for your protection, which is a burden. It may not be a high burden, but it is a burden. You have to bring in something.
Well, isn't it enough that they're bringing a lawsuit?
No, that's enough to get them interested person status. That's all.
And they are making a formal claim against the estate?
They've submitted a formal claim that's been disallowed, yes.
I mean, why isn't that enough?
Because if you submit a claim, anybody can submit a claim that has a claim, but that doesn't mean that the estate needs the burdens of its supervised administration, because we have an obligation to pay valid claims. We have an obligation to set aside assets to do that until we get court approval not to. And if we distribute the assets to the devisees, if we don't have court approval to cut the claims off, they run the risk of getting those assets clawed back. Those are all of the inherent protections for what we're talking about, which is don't dissipate the assets. So if a claimant came in and said, look, the PR is taking a lot of vacations to Tahiti to have PR meetings, that would be a problem, right? And that would be something that the court could point to. But the petition is completely devoid of a single allegation of anything related to it. It's simply a probate petition. And so the court needed something. And the fact that it didn't have something is where the error came in. Because even if it's discretionary, the court errs if it doesn't apply the law correctly. And in this case, the law is very clear.
I have a question, same question for you that I had for Mr. Westrick, and that's, do we publish, and if so, what would the syllabus points be?
I believe that the court should publish so that the state of Minnesota has guidance as to these factors.
The Mellon factors?
I think that it's a combination of the Mellon factors as modified in Colorado, and we lay that out on page, well, it was page 8 at one time, but it's in the second section of our brief where we sort of try to synthesize the three cases because it's the three factors, but then Colorado, which again is a UPC state, goes into detail about how those are applied and some of the things that the court should be looking at doing. So what we considered the actual factors to be are the first three factors, the nature of the claim, the hardship, the adverse effect. But then there's an overarching understanding of the speedy, efficient, and exact system for settling estates, making distribution, that reserving against those contingencies may greatly impede the full distribution of an estate and is contrary to the public policy of a speedy and efficient settlement.
Where are you reading right now?
I am, well, I'm reading from my outline, but I'm pulling the page right here. It is page
17.
18 and 19 of our initial brief. Oh, 17 as well. I think I repeated myself. But 17 is a pretty exact version of what I'm articulating.
I'm seeing it now.
So what we're arguing is to say, look, the Mellon factors are sort of the genesis of this. And then Powers took that, applied it in a UPC state, which has very similar, if not identical, provisions to Minnesota. Specifically, the statute 810 that we're talking about is the same.
So did the Colorado court basically use the Mellon opinion to interpret the word otherwise? Is that my understanding?
What the Colorado court is doing is,
I guess what I mean is, what, you know, which language in the statute was being applied?
I think it's important to understand that the statute isn't the only avenue to the relief, and that's what both Mellon and Powers are saying. The statute 810, specifically, I believe B2, is a option for the court. Another option for the court, and this is the one that we need guidance on because the court didn't know it had this authority in June when it issued its order, it can terminate the claim.
And I guess in my
and that's not allowed under the statute. That's the relief that's allowed under the case law.
And I think that argument of yours is sort of based on the word may, right? May,
yes.
May 10B.
And that's,
and you're saying it may, and that implies that it also.
Well, and it's expanded on in the second Colorado case.
Am I correct in understanding your argument?
You are correct, and specifically if you look at the security savings and loan case, it goes on and talks about the filing of it permits them to set aside the assets. The representative is not required to do so. And because the statute allows either the PR to do this on their own without court approval or for a claimant to go seek it from a court, they're talking about whether or not they have to do it. But it's very, very clear that it's an optional remedy.
Those cases that you've mentioned that speaks to the issue of whether one party or the other has a burden, either as to the necessary issue or any other issue?
So I think in those cases, what was happening is the party that was seeking to have the money withheld was the moving party. And so it was very clear that the burden was on there, so the court didn't go into great detail about the burden in that case. But I believe the burden is on the party seeking the sequestration of funds. So we moved to terminate because it's more expedient than just moving to close the estate and trying to wrap it up at that moment. We wanted to get this piece knocked out. But once we did that, their response has to come in and explain why the court shouldn't allow us to terminate and distribute the assets.
And what's your authority for that?
The authority is that the purpose of the probate statutory scheme is to get assets to the devisees. And so under the initial preamble of the Minnesota Probate Code, it's also elucidated a little bit in Powers and the savings and loan case, is that the overarching purpose is to get that money out, get it out of there, and that anything that's going to impede that, we need to look at. And so it's the responding party in our case, but generally the moving party, that's seeking to have that hold back, and it's their burden to show why it should happen.
Well, I guess what you're saying is there's a rationale for why it should be.
Right.
Well, there's
is there any pre-existing case law that says that or anything?
As far as I've been able to, as far as I've been able to find is these three cases, and they were not the easiest to find. We didn't actually have them at the very initial hearing. The court had asked a sort of related question about what would happen if it got up on appeal and then got reversed, which I don't think has ever happened. But if that did happen, and we couldn't find a case on that point, we did, however, argue this in the second motion. So when the court initially looked at Minnesota law, it did not know about the Powers and Mellon Doctrine. So the court didn't apply it in the June hearing, just so that everybody's clear on that point.
So Mr. Westrick said two syllabus points, Mellon factors, you would say, plus Powers factors. Right. His second point was probate court has the discretion to make a case, to take a case from unsupervised to supervised. And you're saying the probate court has the discretion to determine the validity of a claim.
Yes, and that's I believe what the Mellon factors are.
Okay.
And then with respect to the conversion to supervision, it's a statutory scheme. The court just has to apply it. The application of that, I would agree, is discretionary if there is at least a scintilla of basis for the court to do so.
But you're claiming they didn't even have a scintilla of evidence?
Yeah, if you look at the actual petition, there isn't a single allegation in there. It's the only thing that ever references anything about it is, and it should be supervised with a bond. There's no allegation about how much the amount should be. And if you look at the actual transcript with Referee Moss back in 2016, there's a lot of discussion because, as you'll note in our brief, he sort of set the tone at the beginning and said, look, you're going to lose, but if you'd like to tell me why, I might listen to you. And somehow during that, we were able to get him to not do it. So what's clear is that there wasn't really much there. And there's a little bit of a discussion between him and Mr. Westrick about, well, how much is this? What's there? What are you getting at?
And I guess, so the basis would be that there's not enough to show there's a claim?
No, it's not that there's a show there's a claim. It's that there's harm to persons interested in the estate, because that's what the factor is. It says that it is necessary for the protection of persons interested in the estate, not that there are persons interested in the estate. So it's not sufficient to just sit up and say, I'm a devisee or I'm a creditor or whatever, I'd like it supervised, and sit down. You must get up and say, I'm a devisee and I want it supervised because, and then you have to fill in after because.
But in that, the judge now made this order and basically says, I'm not going to let you distribute these assets because of this claim, basically. I mean, isn't the judge saying that's necessary so that they won't
That's a separate issue than the conversion to supervision.
Well, I know that, but I mean, but that the conversion took place first, and now we have a judge that's basically come up with an order that says, no, we do need to hold back here.
Finding
there's enough evidence here. So, I mean, how can we...
I think what happened is the judge threw his hands up.
How can we unring the bell? I mean, we were already down the road. You're saying that the judge shouldn't even have gotten involved and shouldn't have converted.
No, I'm not saying the judge shouldn't have gotten involved. I'm saying he should have denied the conversion because there wasn't anything in the record to support it. And I think that that's a discrete issue from whether or not he should hold back assets.
How would we basically find in your favor in light of the judge, I think it's Judge Cutter's, decision that yes, there is something there to the extent that I have to hold back the distribution.
All that the orders have said is there's a claim and I can't figure out how much it's worth. And I think that goes to the point of it's their burden to show how much it's worth. And if the court couldn't do that, they shouldn't be rewarded for that.
But you understand the appeal of letting Judge Thunheim figure things out.
Well, Judge Thunheim's out of this.
Yeah. But now the Eighth Circuit rather than.
I do, and that's the purpose of the Mellon and Powers Doctrine, is to say, look, because if you look at Powers, it is virtually identical. It was a case where they were dismissed, and at the time we brought our motion, we were waiting on a Rule 54 because there were still parties that were stuck in the case. That's since been dismissed, but it's virtually identical. The timeline's 3 years, and what those cases say is, look, you've had your shot in the other court. I get you have an appeal, and it could take years, but we're not going to deprive these beneficiaries of this because there's concrete harm to these people. These people might have debts that they can't pay with money that's devolved at death. They might not be able to do things that they are allowed to do because somebody simply asserted a claim. There's a burden on the claimant to step up and do that because there is a concrete harm. And to tie that up for now 4 years, potentially 5 or 6 by the time this is all over with, is wrong, frankly.
Well, but the judge took that into account when she's talking about the balancing of
these
interests.
He didn't believe he had the authority to terminate the claim, and that's why I think it needs to be remanded to tell him he had that authority and let him apply the factors.
Thank you. Mr. Westbrook?
Thank you, Your Honor.
I disagree with counsel on the notion that the probate division here has the right to terminate the claim. I understand that the statute would, there's statutory authority that he could, but Minnesota has long followed the first file rule. And that is as if there's a lawsuit going on in another case. Because remember, the lawsuit was going on before the decedent here passed away. And so that's why this notion that whether we even had to file a claim, we did so out of an abundance of caution, but actually you don't have to file a claim as a general rule if the action is already pending at the time of the decedent's death. Our view is that the decision as to whether or not to convert is so discretionary that it's almost like what the Vangus case say, it's almost subject, it can't be reviewed by the Court of Appeals, and I only say that because judges regularly do this. And my last point is counsel forgets someone who has a claim, albeit not a great claim, they too are an interested person in the estate. And if you dismiss someone's claim before it's resolved, they too may harm.
He actually went further than that, though. He said, you haven't shown that you're going to be harmed in any way, so therefore there's no need for a supervised estate.
My view is the dismissal of a claim while it's pending in another court is in of itself harm. We don't allow, for instance, in real estate matters, if I lose on summary judgment on a real estate claim where I have a lis pendens and I want to appeal to this court, the district court isn't allowed to dismiss the lis pendens and say, nope, sorry, you had your chance, you're gone. That says the lis pendens stays on until the matter's done. And so I understand that counsel says these people are being harmed because they're not getting their money, they may not be able to pay bills. I don't know, is that true? Because I don't know how much money's there. Are we talking about $3 million or are we talking about $150,000? I don't know what we're talking about because this is the only estate I know that I've been involved in many years where there's never been an inventory. Unless there's any more questions, thank the court for the time and attention, and thank you again very much for moving this. I appreciate it.
Thank you to you. Do you have any rebuttal since you're cross-appellant just with regard to his rebuttal?
Yes, just very, very briefly. I think the important thing to keep in mind is that the entire purpose of Mellon and Powers is that this is different. So all the examples of first filed and all those things is that the courts across the country have said in probate matters, the rules are different. It's not just a matter of comity and looking at what somebody else has done or not done. It's a, we're going to do a review, and in this case, we're going to balance the interests of the devisees of the estate and the potential claimant, and we're going to look at the quality of their claim, we're going to look at the scope of their claim, and we may cut it off, and we understand that cutting it off may cause harm to the claimant, and that's the balance that we're going to do, and what I'm asking the court to do is to say, this is the standard that we're going to adopt in Minnesota, this is what the court's powers are, and court, now that you know what those are, please apply them.
Thank you. Case. And we'll have our decision out within 90 days.